understanding process. That's the beginning of understanding that we're not the body. And gradually, that's a form of yoga that leads us to realize that we're not the body, to actually know that we are something beyond this body, that there's a soul within this body, and that it is transcendental to the death experience. That death experience comes and has to continue. And by transcendental knowledge, by learning transcendental knowledge through reading and associating, chanting, there's two or three principal processes: chanting, studying, or what we call hearing, reading, associating with devotees. We learn gradually how to shape our destiny such that we don't have to keep coming back in a cycle. And ultimately, when one reaches a pure stage of consciousness, he is effectively a spiritual being entirely, even though within this material body. This is called Jivan Mukta, or the stage, fully liberated stage, in which the jiva, the living entity, becomes liberated. Mukti means liberation. So in that Jivan Mukti state, he's fully conscious of his spiritual existence and completely detached from the body, from the sense of pain and pleasure, fame, infamy, and so on. And when such a being, when experiences death, or when the body of such a person, more explicitly, is no longer functioning, heart stops and all the functions cease, then that soul is transformed into a spiritual body rather than a material body. So, and it takes birth as a spiritual being. So it's essentially by yogic practice, by bhakti yoga, constant practice, and by what we call surrender. Actually, it says that in the end of the Bhagavad Gita. Sarvadhammam parityaja mame kam sharanam braja. Aham tvam sarvapakajo moksha ishyami masuchaha. That means to abandon all varieties of religious duty. This Bhagavad Gita is a series of verses that talk about various types of, quote, religious, end quote, duties or rituals. But in the ultimate, one is advised to give even those up and come to the platform of pure love of God, surrender, which is beyond any denominational consideration. So by this process of surrender and by yoga practice, one comes to that point of purity and can transcend the material cycle. It's a gradual, a very gradual process. Is that all right? Anything, any other comments or questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
About Prahlad Maharaj. So today we're going to read a couple of verses from the Srimad Bhagavatam, the 7th canto, 9th chapter, that were often quoted by Srila Prabhupada and often expounded upon both in speech and in writing. So we'll speak a little and then we can have some discussion afterwards if there's time. This is the 7th canto, 9th chapter. Text 43. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Vodvije Paraduratyaya Vataranyas. Svadvīryagāya namaham ritamāgna chītā śo cheta to vimukha cheta sa indriyārtā maya sukhaya bharamudvahato vimudhān. O best of the great personalities, these are Prahlad's prayers to Lord Śrīngadev after he has dispensed with Hiranyakashipu. O best of the great personalities, I am not at all afraid of material existence, for wherever I stay, I am fully absorbed in thoughts of your glories and activities. My concern is only for the fools and rascals who are making elaborate plans for material happiness and maintaining their families, societies, and countries, I am simply concerned with love for them. I'll read the purport by Srila Prabhupada. Throughout the entire world, everyone is making big, big plans to adjust the miseries of the material world. And this is true at present, in the past and in the future. Nonetheless, although they make elaborate political, social, and cultural plans, they have all been described herein as vimudha, fools. The material world has been described in Bhagavad Gita as dukkhalayam ashashvatam, temporary and miserable. But these fools are trying to turn the material world into sukhalaya, a place of happiness, not knowing how everything acts by the arrangement of material nature, which works in her own way. Prakrite kriyamanane gunai karma sarvashaha ahankara vimudhatma ataham iti manyate. Bewildered spirit soul, under the influence of the three modes of material nature, thinks himself to be the doer of activities that are in fact carried out by nature. From Bhagavad Gita 3:27. There is a plan for material nature, personally known as Durga, to punish the demons. Although the asuras, the godless demons, struggle for existence, they are directly attacked by the goddess Durga, who is well equipped with 10 hands, with different types of weapons to punish them. She is carried by her lion carrier, or the modes of passion and ignorance. Everyone struggles very hard to fight through the modes of passion and ignorance and conquer material nature. But at the end, everyone is vanquished by nature's laws. There is a river known as Vaitarani between the material and spiritual worlds. And one must cross this river to reach the other side, or the spiritual world. This is an extremely difficult task. As the Lord says in Bhagavad Gita, Daivihyesha Gunamayi Mama Maya Durachaya, this divine energy of mine, consisting of the three modes of material nature, is difficult to overcome. The same word, Durachaya, meaning very difficult, is used here. Therefore, one cannot surpass the stringent laws of material nature except by the mercy of the Supreme Lord. Nonetheless, although all materialists are baffled in their plans, they try again and again to become happy in this material world. Therefore, they have been described as vimudha, first-class fools. As for Prahlad Maharaj, he was not at all unhappy, for although he was in the material world, he was full of Krishna consciousness. Those who are Krishna conscious, trying to serve the Lord, are not unhappy, whereas one who has no assets in Krishna consciousness is struggling for existence, and is struggling for existence is not only foolish, but extremely unhappy also. Prahlad Maharaj was happy and unhappy simultaneously. He felt happiness and transcendental bliss because of his Krishna consciousness, yet he felt great unhappiness for the fools and rascals who make elaborate plans to be happy in the material world. I'll just read the text, the next verse, not the purport. It goes on, My dear Lord Nisringadev, I see that there are many saintly persons indeed, but they are interested only in their own deliverance. Not caring for the big cities and towns, they go to the Himalayas or the forest to meditate with vows of silence, Monavrata. They are not interested in delivering others. As for me, however, I do not wish to be liberated alone, leaving aside all these poor fools and rascals. I know that without Krishna consciousness, without taking shelter of your lotus feet, one cannot be happy. Therefore, I wish to bring them back to shelter at your lotus feet. Krishna also emphasizes this in the Bhagavad Gita. Yaidam paramanguyam madbhakte shavidashiti. One who preaches the glories of Krishna to the masses is very dear to Krishna. Yaidam paramanguyam. And he goes on to say that such a person is the most dear of all. There is no one more dear to the Supreme Lord than one who canvasses on his behalf or one who preaches his message. Acts as his agent. So Prahlad's happiness and unhappiness is very instructive. He's not unhappy for himself because he's actually merged in transcendental ecstasy at every moment. But his sadness is for those who have not the benefit or the privilege to be engaged in thoughts of Krishna at every moment. So he doesn't desire transcendental benefits for himself. And as we see later on, he begs the Lord to forgive his own father, even though he tried in so many ways to kill him. He ask specifically for him to be liberated, for him to be delivered. So that's the quality of a devotee. Lord Chaitanya stressed this quality of compassion and tolerance. Lord Chaitanya is famous for stating this verse, that one should always be very tolerant, more than the tree, forbearing, humble like the grass, and never ask for respect and always offer respect to others. This, he said, you should wear this garland. This is part of his shikshastakam, around your neck always, just like a flower garland. Wear this verse around your neck, just like a flower garland. So Prahlad also exhibited this quality. He was forbearing, even though his father tried to kill him. And afterward, he was not only forgiving, but he begged the Lord a special favor. He asked him, you can have anything you want. What do you want? I ask you. You can have any benediction. The Supreme Lord was directly asking him. No, I don't want anything for myself. I simply want that others who are suffering, they should get the same sense of Krishna consciousness that I have. Let them be happy. The characteristic, as we know in the material world, is that we are envious of others, or we are plagued by the dual characteristics explained in the Bhagavad Gita as desire and hate. Icha desha, desire and hate. Those are the characteristics of the material world. We desire to have something we don't have, and we are envious of those who have the thing that we have. Also, we are hankering for things we don't have, and we're lamenting for things, hankering things we don't have, and for lamenting for things that we couldn't do in the past. So our materialistic nature tells us that I feel happy when others are unhappy, and unhappy when others are happy. That's the nature of the material world. That's our envious, or our lower nature. Our lower nature is when someone is benedicted or having good fortune, we tend to feel sad because we don't have it. And when someone is having misfortune or bad luck, things go wrong, then we tend to feel, well, that's good. That didn't happen to me, so I feel very happy. That's our nature. Therefore, we see so much money is being made in the newspapers or on television. They're showing so much misery. And everyone's thinking, well, it's not happening to me, so I feel very good. At least it's not happening to me. So this nature is being exploited. Nature, our envious nature is being exploited. It's there, and it's possible to exploit this tendency and become very wealthy by exploiting this tendency. So the purpose of pursuing spiritual life is to overcome this tendency and to be tolerant in all conditions and to be able to transcend these natural feelings of envy. In the spiritual world, there is no such thing as envy. It's described in the Chaitanya Chaitamrita and other parts of the Vedic literature that although there is competition, the gopis are competing for Krishna's favor. One is performing a nice service, making Krishna a flower garland. Another gopi is making some foodstuffs. And they're thinking, she has made a very beautiful garland for Krishna. Let me make some wonderful prasadam, which will please Krishna even more. But this is not material envy, because both want to see the other glorified. It's not that one wishes to see the other diminished. So everything is increasing in the spiritual world. Love for Krishna is increasing. And each devotee in the spiritual world is encouraging the other to increase his or her love for Krishna, to go higher and higher. So as opposed to the nature of material pleasure, spiritual pleasure is increasing in an ever-ending, never-ending upward spiral. Whereas we perform some service or have some good fortune in the material world, it's there for some time, and then it fades away and ends in oblivion. Or there is envy, and someone is trying to take away somebody else's pleasure. But in the spiritual world, everything is increasing. Pleasure is increasing, service is increasing, love is increasing. So Prahlad Maharaj exhibited endless compassion. There was no bounds to his compassion. He wanted everyone in the material world to be liberated. And we read of many other great saints. Today is, in fact, the disappearance day of Haridasa Thakur, a great contemporary of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He is glorified as the Namacharya, the Acharya of the Holy Name. He also desired that all the living entities would be liberated. This was his fondest desire. And Vasudev Dutt, another contemporary of Lord Chaitanya, the 16th century, he also prayed to Lord Chaitanya that I want to accept all the sins of all the living entities all over the universe. I want to accept the reactions from all their sins upon myself. Please do that so they can be liberated. Please transfer all their sinful activity onto my head so that they can then be liberated, and let me somehow suffer for all of them. And Lord Chaitanya was very kind upon him. So, in our present environment, we hear how Lord Jesus Christ also suffered. He wanted to suffer for the sins of all of his contemporaries. That's the mood of a pure devotee. He wants to suffer if others can be alleviated from suffering. So this is very extreme. Maybe it's a little difficult to understand for us. But these paragons of Krishna consciousness, like Prahlad, Haridasa Thakur, and even Jesus Christ, and so many other great saints and rishis, who wanted to see others be happy, to give them Krishna consciousness, were willing to go to great extremes to suffer on their own. When Haridasa Thakur, since it's his disappearance day, will relate some incidents about his life, was captured. He was his captors were instructed to beat him to death in public in all the major marketplaces of Navadvip. So we understand the esoteric understanding of Haridasa Thakur is that he is sometimes described as an incarnation of Lord Brahma, or at least a partial incarnation, and sometimes elsewhere as an incarnation of Prahlad Maharaj, who we're reading about here, or a partial incarnation of Prahlad Maharaj. So he was the embodiment of compassion. When his captors took him out to cane him in 19 different marketplaces, they beat him with sticks, but he did not go unconscious, he did not die. They took him to one marketplace after the other. The idea was the present government wanted to establish that what he was doing was punishable, and therefore establish a precedent. Anyway, they didn't succeed after beating him severely, and then they finally confessed that they were very frightened. They said, if we go back to our master and say that we didn't dispense with you, that you are still alive, we will be killed. What can we do? So taking compassion upon them, he said, that's all right. I don't want you to be killed. I don't want you to suffer. You just throw my dead body in the Ganga, and I will never return, and I will drown, and they will never see me again. So in this way, he was able to save the lives of his captors. And of course, he later was washed ashore, and he survived. But he was willing to suffer, even though they were beating him and the idea was to kill him, he was willing to suffer just to save them. So devotees are willing to undergo many, many risks and even suffer for the sake of their work. Bhaktivinoda Thakur also, who was Srila Prabhupada's guru's father, also a very great Vaishnava, we observed his appearance day just a few days ago, was also very concerned. He wrote many songs where he described the compassionate nature of a devotee, Paraduka Duki, one who feels the suffering of others as his own suffering. So as Prabhupada comments here, there are many spiritualists who prefer to seek their own otherworldly salvation or perfection. And the characteristic of Vaishnava is he doesn't want to go back to Godhead alone. Dhruva Maharaj also exhibited the same characteristic. When he was liberated, he insisted that his mother, who put him on the path of liberation and Krishna consciousness, go with him back to Godhead. He refused to go alone. So devotees are very gracious. They personify gratitude. They're so grateful to the Supreme Lord who has so kindly given them Krishna consciousness or lifted them out of the nescience of materialism that they want to devote the rest of eternity to repay them. Ye tamam prabhajante tam sitaya vajamiham vartmanivartante manusha partasavashaha. There is a very wonderful and transcendental loving reciprocal relationship between Krishna and his devotees. The devotee, once he realizes that Krishna's mercy is with him, he feels he can never repay the Supreme Lord. It's like Prahlad, he suffered so much and Lord Nrisimhadev came personally to liberate him. Yet he felt there was, in these prayers he's offering to the Lord, there's no limit to how much he feels he has to repay the Supreme Lord. So it is said that one can never repay one's debt to Krishna or the spiritual master. That's the feeling of a devotee. So because he's giving this instruction, that he wants so many conditioned souls to be relieved of their misery, and he's sending his agents. And his agents feel they can never offer enough souls to go back to Godhead. So devotees feel they want to deliver as many souls as possible to go back to Godhead. As Prabhupada writes, the material nature is very cruel. Even one who becomes very successful in the material world, at some point, everything is taken away. Or sometimes it's taken away immediately. So the nature is like that. Chanchala, Dukalaya, Shashvatam, it's moving up and down, full of duality. And one who is truly intelligent, Nateshu Ramate Buddha, he does not take pleasure in temporary happiness. He does not delight in these temporary things of the senses, the mind, the body, the intellect. This is what distinguishes intelligence from ignorance. There's a nice verse in the Bhagavad Gita in the 13th chapter that describes all the qualities of a devotee, among which are knowledge and being able to distinguish matter from spirit. And anything which is contrary to these are described there as being ignorance. So all of these qualities that are exhibited by devotees, these are called knowledge. All the qualities of knowledge are exhibited. Forbearance, tolerance, humility, simplicity, gravity, perfection, compassion, attachment to Krishna, detachment from the material world. These are the qualities that are seen, evident in the body of a devotee. He's always exhibiting these qualities. And the great fortune to have a pure devotee like Prabhupada who came into our midst was that he exemplified these qualities at every moment, not just when he was teaching or giving some instruction to a disciple, but at every moment these qualities are manifest. So when Lord Chaitanya came also, he's considered the invisible incarnation of Krishna, the incarnation who is not seen. Because when he came 500 years ago, he did not play the role of an incarnation of Vishnu, but rather he completely exhibited the role of a devotee of Lord Vishnu. So he's considered the invisible avatar. He was completely absorbed in the role of a devotee. So in that way, even though Krishna came personally 5,000 years ago to speak the Bhagavad Gita and provide the perfection of instruction through the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Chaitanya was even more kind because he came and exhibited everything a devotee should do. He took us through this instruction by his example. He didn't simply order or teach, but he acted out the role of a devotee. He was always very, very dear and acting in a way that was equal to all of his contemporaries. He glorified all of his followers as if they were greater than he was. He was always chanting the name of Krishna. He was always leading big Sankirtan parties, chanting and dancing. And he just went everywhere. As he walked the whole length and breadth of India. And in this way, distributed love of Godhead just like a great flood, like a great tidal wave, and gave every breath for this purpose. And sometimes we would see Lord Chaitanya, he came before Lord Jagannath. He prostrated himself, he became unconscious. Sometimes he exhibited the symptoms of a devotee in ecstasy. He would sometimes tremble, laugh, cry. And when he was carrying on his great discourse with Prakasananda Saraswati in Benares, he was asked, why are you chanting like this instead of studying Vedanta? And he said that my spiritual master, he told me that you should just chant and dance. That should be your main business. He said, I was not so intelligent that I could understand Vedanta, but I was told to chant and dance. And as I began to chant the holy name of God and dance in ecstasy, I felt transcendental ecstasy. And somehow this transcendental sound vibration took over my whole body and mind, and I began to chant and dance like a madman. So the assembly in Benares appreciated Lord Chaitanya's presentation and could understand by his behavior and his speech that he was actually a full manifestation of the Supreme Lord. So in this way he traveled all over India and brought love of God like a great tidal wave. And Bhakti Vinod, who was in, of course, the same succession, predicted that one day that devotees would come from all over the world to chant and dance Jai Sachi Nandana in the holy city of Mayapur, or what was then considered part of Navadvip. They would come from every country in the world and chant and dance in ecstasy, regardless of their nation of origin or their race or their social status or their sex or anything. They would come and chant and dance in ecstasy together. Bhaktivinoda predicted this over 100 years ago. And he also predicted there would be a great personality who would spread this Harinam, chanting the Maha Mantra, all over the world. And of course he was benedicted by a great son, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, who ordered his disciple, Srila Prabhupada, to do just that, inasmuch as he said, you will please take this Krishna consciousness to the English-speaking world. So coming down from Krishna himself, through Lord Chaitanya, Bhaktivinoda, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, Srila Prabhupada, this mood of Prahlad Maharaj is exemplified. To take great risk and undergo great pains and austerities to liberate the conditioned souls, to educate them, to give them the power to distinguish between knowledge and ignorance, between spiritual pleasure and material pleasure. It's the Bhagavad Gita describes that spiritual, in the 17th chapter, that spiritual intelligence is a little difficult in the beginning. It's almost like poison. But it is nectar afterwards, in the end. And similarly, material life is sometimes very enjoyable in the beginning. You see, when we're young, everything is a very wonderful, new, fresh experience. Then in old age, practically speaking, all the very same things are painful. So the material world is fraught with difficulty. And although pleasurable in the beginning, every pleasure, as described in the Bhagavad Gita, has a beginning and an end. Mateshu Ramate Buddha. So to be able to distinguish, this is what marks a sadhu, to be able to convey that actually everything that we see around us, everything that bodes great happiness and pleasure, wonderful, beautiful nature, so many fine songs, and beautiful creations by man, by nature, are a source of great happiness. So much wonderful poetry and music. But a sadhu is able to distinguish matter from spirit. And all of these wonderful, beautiful things, Krishna says, they all spring from but a spark of my splendor. So a sadhu knows that everything that is wonderful, great, beautiful, that comes from the Supreme Lord. That is just a tiny, tiny fraction of what the Supreme Lord is. And because it's temporary, one becomes very careful not to become attached to that which is temporary. And he seeks his pleasure from within. Because Krishna is very kind, as soon as we take one step towards him, he takes 10 steps towards us. So, as Krishna says, a little bit of effort on this path brings great rewards. There is no diminution. So we're very fortunate to have had the association of such great souls as Prahlad Maharaj, and through Srila Prabhupada, we're having his association, having the association of Haridas Thakur and Lord Chaitanya. When Prabhupada came to the West, very few people had ever heard of Lord Chaitanya, or even Krishna for that matter. But because of Prabhupada's devotion, his exemplary practice and his devotion, just by the way he worshipped Lord Chaitanya and Krishna, immediately there was an understanding that here is a great personality who is worshipping Krishna or God as he should be worshipped. So devotees will always be characterized not by what they say only, but by how they act and what they do. So great man is measured. By his deeds. And when his deeds are exemplary, then all the world will pursue them. So the nature of Krishna consciousness is that it is ever expanding. Just like spirit, it is always growing. Something we don't have experience of. It continues to grow and expand. So, since a devotee is very humble, his heart is very great. It is described in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu by Rupa Goswami that a devotee's heart becomes very, very big. It actually begins to melt like butter because he's very humble and very compassionate. So it's a credit and a great privilege to be here to see that so many of you have labored so hard out of your own compassion and devotion to Krishna and compassion for others, and following the footsteps of Srila Prabhupada to open this nice center and give everybody access. Prabhupada's vision was so scientific. He opened so many centers all over the world, almost 300 now. And even now we have so many little sub-centers, namhat groups. But he didn't simply wander about, but he created an entire little Hare Krishna universe on his planet with the idea that some millions and millions of books, he set up a system to distribute these books by the millions, literally, and then provide centers where people who became interested could further pursue Krishna consciousness in the association of devotees and the deities, or the Supreme Lord. So this is Prabhupada's great genius. He didn't simply give lectures, or didn't simply write a few books, or open a few centers. He did all those things so that the most systematic way possible to give everyone access to Krishna consciousness would be there. And this way, fully exhibited the characteristics of a Mahabhagavat, like Prahlad Maharaj. There's no limit to the pure devotee's mercy. When they think of the condition of suffering humanity, they they actually cry, feeling the same pain as their own. So these great visions and institutions that Prabhupada has set up were done simply with that idea, to alleviate the suffering of the living entities. As Prahlad says, my only concern is for the fools and rascals who are making elaborate plans for material happiness and maintaining their families, societies, and countries. I'm simply concerned with love for them. So as this great Mahabhagavat, Prahlad Maharaj could see. So even at the age of 5 years old, he was assembling all of his schoolmates who are from very substantially well-to-do families, getting them to chant Hare Krishna in ecstasy, and teaching them that actually this material life is very temporary, even at great risk to himself. He was just speaking the truth. A devotee always speaks very truthfully. Sometimes it may be a little unpleasant. But the fact is that the truth is the truth. Of course, with austerity of the tongue, he's speaking very pleasantly according to time, place, and circumstance. Even though it is maybe a hard and difficult truth, he's speaking in a very palatable way. This is called austerity of the tongue. One has to speak satya priya hitam chaya, that which is truthful but also in a pleasing way, and that which is very beneficial and not agitating, and always speaking from Vedic literature. So these are the characteristics and qualities of a sadhu. And even though we are all neophytes and followers, if we try to convey what we have learned without any motivation to gain anything for ourselves, but simply to transmit spiritual knowledge, then it will be effective. So it doesn't matter whether we're neophytes or somewhat practiced, or whether we're initiated or uninitiated. If the impetus to repeat what we've heard is there, then we will be successful. Just like Prabhupada used to say constantly, if I have any success, or if I'm due any credit, the only credit is that I have tried to repeat what my spiritual master said. Bhaktisiddhanta was a great, great, another Mahabhava. And in that repeating process, if I have repeated purely without any motivation, without any ulterior motive, then I feel my life has been a success. So this is the nature of evam parampara praptam evam rajasya yogita parampara, to transmit without any motivation spiritual knowledge coming from Krishna himself. And therefore, we can see how nicely the center is grown up, not by some material calculation, but by the direct mercy of Krishna, in fact. These things don't happen by some material calculation, but they happen by the energy that's coming through the devotees from Krishna himself. Otherwise, how is it possible that so much Krishna consciousness could spread around the world in such a short time? That is Krishna himself. So I'll read the verse again. O best of the great personalities, I am not at all afraid of material existence. Wherever I stay, I am fully absorbed in thoughts of your glories and activities. My concern is only for the fools and rascals who are making elaborate plans for material happiness and maintaining their families, societies, and countries. I am simply concerned with love for them. And one last comment, and we can have some questions. Prahlad Maharaj is the personification of the devotional principle of Smaranam. That is, he was never for a moment not thinking of Krishna. Even when he was pushed off the edge of a cliff, when he was thrown into a pit of snakes, his meditation was never broken, not for one second. And due to this fearlessness, Krishna always protected him. He couldn't be killed. So the idea of Krishna consciousness is to come to that point of meditation, where even though we have to live in the material world and act in the material world, somehow we should train ourselves so that our meditation on Krishna, particularly through vibrating the Maha Mantra, is never broken. So we'll stop there. And you'd like to ask anything or say anything?
Maharaj, some historical records of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu meeting Guru Nanakji. Could you elaborate on that?
I'm not familiar. I've heard that there was a meeting like that. I don't know. Maybe somebody else knows. Do you know? Anything more?
No. You have not heard of that.
I've heard such a thing took place, but I don't know any details.
Might be, but that has not been mentioned anywhere in the books of Sikhs or anywhere in our literature regarding Mahaprabhu Chaitanya.
Yeah.
That have not,
that's true.
Maybe that somebody might have, out of affection or out of Shraddha, he might have said that this happened, but actually that I don't think. Because that time was a little bit earlier, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's. Guru Nanak has been at a later age.
Yes.
Because at the time of Guru Nanak, his Vrindavan and Mathura Vrindavan sites were existing. And here this Swami Haridas, he was a later incarnation than Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
Hmm.
So Swami Haridas was living at that time in Vrindavan. Vrindavan was actually traced out by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because when he came over to Vrindavan site, he got into trance and he was telling that here Bhagavan had this leela and Bhagavan had this leela. All that sites were explored by him, not by any person. They are not so old. If we can say that these were the sites, they were populated at that time. They were not populated. But they were explored in the stage of trance. When he went to a certain place and Lord Krishna has done his leela there. So he went into trance at that place. He made out that this sort of leela was done at this place. So those places were taken out as places of worship. At the time of Guru Nanak, these places were existing.
Hmm.
So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is a bit earlier than Guru Nanak.
Hmm. Thank you. So any other points?
Swami Maharaj?
Yes.
Why did Krishna send Srila Prabhupada?
Said in his first meeting that you were very young men, you should preach Krishna consciousness. You're young and educated, intelligent and educated, you should preach. So one might ask, why did Prabhupada wait from 1933 to 1965? And of course Prabhupada was working very hard in that period. He began Back to Godhead magazine, he took sannyas, he began translating Srimad Bhagavatam, and he had actually made a commitment in his mind to fulfill this order of his Guru Maharaj, and he was actually planning ever since that time, constantly thinking, he explained, how to fulfill this mission. So he had actually begun and completed three volumes, three books, which was the first canto, and at one point he was able to present them in libraries, presented them to Lal Shastri and so on, and got some recognition. So once actually Prabhupada was asked, why is it that you waited 30 years, more than 32 years, to fulfill the mission of your guru? He said, well, he gave me a very great task. I had to prepare. It's not easy to bring Krishna consciousness all over the world. So it's very difficult. And sometimes we, in our modern way of doing things, are due to our Western ways, those of us Western, we tend to do things rather hastily, without proper foresight or proper thought. But one of the qualities of a devotee, he's very enthusiastic and at the same time he's very patient. These qualities are mentioned in the Nectar of Instruction. First, there's enthusiasm, and then somehow there's patience. So these are a little contradictory on the surface, but actually, when one prosecutes all the different characteristics, he's enthusiastic, he's patient, he's determined, he's able to fulfill the desires of the Supreme Lord. So even though Prabhupada was apparently in a less capable condition in that old age, he was planning everything very, very carefully. As we see from his biography, everything led up to the next thing, to the next thing. And if we examine it from a historical or sociological point of view, we can see that he came in 1966 right into the midst of the part of the world where there were the greatest number of young people who were most receptive to spiritual life. He came to San Francisco in 1966 during the period of the hippies, or the hate era, H-A-I-G-H-T, it was Haight Street, Haight Ashbury. And things began to happen very quickly. There were a lot of resources at Prabhupada's disposal. So he came at a time when there was great receptivity towards Krishna consciousness. So if we look at the whole thing, see how Prabhupada prepared, and when he arrived, what his reception was, and how he was able to... Of course, his ripe old age also had a very favorable effect on the public. Sometimes younger people are unable to be so revered or respected. But Prabhupada, he came as everyone's grandfather, so to speak. So he could speak very strongly about controversial points, and people would accept because of his old age. And sometimes he would even say, I can say like that, but you cannot say it, because I'm an old man. So all these things and many others, when we analyze Prabhupada's life up to the time he came, we can see that actually everything was arranged by Krishna. Krishna was giving special mercy to his pure devotee and just arranged everything perfectly so that he would be successful. Yes.
Maharaji, is it true that the appearance of Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the reference to that is given in the Srimad Bhagavatam somewhere?
Yes. Krishna Varnam Toshash Krishnam, Twisha Krishnam. It's described that he would appear, that's in the 11th canto, and that he would have a complexion of gold. It's also described that those who followed him, he would be described as, that those in Kali Yuga would chant the holy name, those who would follow Krishna would chant the holy name, those endowed with sufficient brain substance. So he's predicted there and in many other shastras as well. Sometimes it's described as Tri-Yuga. And the Vedas are so perfect, Prabhupada said, that they predict the appearance. And he mentions it specifically in reference to Srimad Bhagavatam in the first canto, fifth chapter, that the Bhagavatam predicted many things would take place, and one after the other they are coming to pass. Just like the appearance of Lord Buddha was predicted, his place of birth. So many things. The characteristics of Kali-Yuga in the 12th canto are very elaborately explained. Things that we see happening all around us now. It's there, yes, in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Yes.
You mentioned about the receptivity of the youth of the 60s. How do you see the youth of today in comparison?
Did everyone hear the question? Yes. Instead, we spoke of the receptivity of the youth of the 60s, of the youth of the 60s. How do we see the present day's youth in comparison? One characteristic of a devotee is that he's spiritually an opportunist, inasmuch as he, in practicing bhakti yoga, learns the art of transforming matter into spirit and spirit into matter. So sometimes we view a particular situation as propitious or inauspicious according to circumstances. Now, we generally view a war as a very inauspicious thing. But we also know that during wartime, people tend to become more religious. Those who are tending towards atheists, they begin to go to church. Their wives and daughters and mothers, they pray for their husbands and children to come back from the war, their fathers to come back from the war. So whether a situation is ostensibly favorable or unfavorable, a devotee, he can see behind everything. Just as I remember, Prabhupada was saying once, he was during the war in India, he was in a bomb shelter, and he said, "I was thinking to myself, this is a very good fortune, because if I die now while I'm young and I can chant the holy name with great determination, and I'm not so old that I can't remember things anymore, well, I can still remember Krishna, this would be very auspicious for me." So similarly, we saw Prabhupada come into a very, what appeared to be a very apropos period, very receptive audience. People were singing Om, they were reading books about spiritual wisdom, they were chanting, they were looking for an alternative to materialism. Their qualification was they were fed up with materialism. So today, we find a different set of circumstances. Maybe in some ways the youth are more materialistic, but we see the wonder of Krishna consciousness is that it's still universally attractive. And so instead of approaching those who are materially exhausted, now we're approaching those who are materially full of desire. Akama, sakama. This is explained, known as the Atmarama verse. That whether one is full of desire or devoid of material desire, still he must chant the holy name. So what we find is that those who are looking for material advancement, they can also see something in Krishna consciousness. There are different types of people who come to Krishna consciousness, explain the Bhagavad Gita. One is one who is suffering, another is one who is seeking after wealth. So, even if one is full of desire and seeking after wealth, he also can find something in Krishna consciousness. Because what is he trying to do? He's trying to improve the quality of his life. He's looking to become stronger, healthier, more beautiful, to have more enjoyment. So when we present Krishna consciousness, that actually there is more pleasure in Krishna consciousness. Krishna is more beautiful than anyone you can relate to. Krishna is wealthier than you'll ever be. They can see some benefit in Krishna consciousness. So although the tendency is to become spiritual when we're suffering, more people come out of suffering, If Krishna consciousness is presented exactly as it is, it will be attractive to all people. So now we see, in this period 20 years later, that even though there's not so much youth that's dissatisfied, still there's attraction to Krishna consciousness. In a different way, they're engaging in service. Maybe in the 60s, people used to just straight move into the temple. That was it. They had nothing else, so they'd move into the temple. Today, of course, this is more prominent in America, where people are more, there's a better economy than there is in this country. But those same people, now they're directly engaging in some form of service. They have some specialized service. So they may not move into the temple, but they become devotees wherever they are, and they learn how to develop the art of bhakti yoga. If they have some professional skills, then we engage that skill in Krishna service. If they know science or computers or accounting or some other form of technology, there's so much now that they can engage in Krishna service. I was just reading a report from a devotee named Rasaraj in Bombay, who is a scientist in computer science. He's been conducting workshops all over the city of Bombay to bring spirituality back to the schools. There's a great fear in Bombay now, that he wrote one statistic that some 30% of the school children in Bombay, not just colleges, but school children, are using drugs now. Many are addicted. So the school principals are very concerned, and they have a board, a morality board, in Bombay. So Rasaraj, after several presentations of Krishna consciousness in ITT and other technical schools in Baroda, Bombay, and Delhi, was invited by this morality board to speak to the principals of several schools, and they conducted this last month, a seminar among several dozen school principals, that if the idea of Bhagavad Dharma, Krishna consciousness, or spiritual life in any form, he was explaining from the perspective of Bhagavad Sanatana Dharma, could be introduced scientifically, from the scientific perspective in the schools, that morality could be reintroduced. So this group of principals was specifically dealing with the question of morality. That was their specialized field. So even though here were a group of students and schools whose main business was to create a better standard of material life, they were understanding that here is a way to temper the tendency of these students who are doing very nicely, so that they wouldn't be attracted by drugs and other forms of immorality, to bring them back to a better way of life, even material life, by practicing Krishna consciousness. So he's been very successful with that, and we can see that even though the main impetus in these schools is to create a higher material standard, by adding Krishna consciousness, even that standard can be brought up. So even though times and places will change, Krishna consciousness is so wonderful that it can be accepted by anyone, whether he's full of material desire or whether he's devoid of material desire. Still, he's attracted to the holy name. So we're not dependent on a particular so-called market of people, but we're dependent on the holy name. And we can see wherever it's vibrated. It's like we go, our experiences out on the street. Every day we go out in Harinam in some form or other, that whether they're driving a Mercedes or riding a motorbike, they're still attracted to Krishna consciousness. Whether they're a beggar or a banker, they're attracted by this chanting of the holy name. Yes?
Maharaj, how can we compare Krishna consciousness with other religions of the world? For example, Christianity.
Prabhupada used to say that the purpose of religious life is to develop love for God. That's the common thread running through all religion. So it's not so much even a matter of comparison, because this is the root of every religious sentiment. To develop our sense of God and love for God. So that is the common thread. Now obviously that is being exhibited by Krishna, by his followers, by Lord Chaitanya, to develop love for God. So this is called the eternal religion, love for God. Sometimes Prabhupada also described it as a science, because it's he presented in a scientific way how we can develop love for God. But this is the purpose. If love for God is developed, then from any denomination, then we're successful, if we develop our love for the Supreme Lord. It's not dependent on denomination, it's dependent on our love for God. So it doesn't matter what denomination one's coming from, as long as we develop that sense of love for God. Prabhupada used to say many times, it doesn't matter what your religion is, if you can simply learn how to love God, then your life is perfect. Prabhupada.
So that if you are the minister of public affairs for the whole world, for this world, could you throw some light about what's happening to devotees and ISKCON movement in communist countries, in particular China and Russia?
Well, as you may know, we were legalized in the Soviet Union this year. The devotees had a worldwide campaign because they were suppressed for many years. When they were found to have been practicing Krishna consciousness, their books were confiscated, their religious paraphernalia like their beads, their deities, their pictures were confiscated. They were put in labor camps, in jails, and insane asylums, which are specifically for people who are dissident. They're not necessarily for people that are clinically insane, but sometimes they were declared to be at the risk of compromising the psychiatric profession of the Soviet Union to be insane when they in fact weren't. And the international psychiatric community condemned many Soviet psychiatrists for this practice, not just for devotees of Krishna, but for people of many faiths who were jailed. There's an international association which condemned them in a meeting about 8 years ago, and they subsequently withdrew from this convention or association. International Association of Psychiatrists. So it had been a practice to declare people insane for political purposes, and psychiatrists around the world censured them for this. So there was police brutality, there was the abuse of psychiatry to put them in what they call psycho prisons, there was abuse on the streets, there were many unnecessary arrests and warnings. They made it impossible for devotees to work once they'd been arrested. It went on their record. So in every way they could possibly do so, they tried to stop Krishna consciousness being spread. Nonetheless, because the books had been introduced into the Soviet Union in the Moscow Book Fair over 10 years ago, people had begun to read the books, they'd begun to duplicate the books, they'd begun to produce the books on their own, and through a vast and sophisticated underground network, they distributed them from one end of the Soviet Union to the other, east to west, north to south, and are still being very, very widely read. So finally, after some devotees actually died in labor camps, we launched an international campaign and visited embassies and high commissions in many countries of the world, staged protests, even made a popular record in Australia. We wrote thousands of letters to the Soviet government. The United States government was very helpful through the State Department in pleading on behalf of the devotees. Of course, they may have had some political motive, but nonetheless, they certainly wrote some very strong letters and negotiated to have some of these devotees released. And at the summit meeting in January of last year, beginning of this year, I'm sorry, at the summit meeting, a presentation was made between the delegates, and the U.S. delegation handed the Soviet delegation a paper with a list of prisoners they insisted to be released as part of the summit meeting exchange that was agreed upon in the realm of human rights, and Anantashanti's name was present on that list. So anyway, by this campaign, they were finally legalized, and now it is official in the Soviet Union, an official religion registered. And as a result of this, in the Calcutta Rath Yatra in July of this year, members of the Communist Party in the state of Bengal came to the Rath Yatra, and the wife of the first minister, the ambassador, the wife of the ambassador, and the second person in charge, the second council, took part in the parade. The lady offered arti to the Lord Jagannath, and the first counselor, the second man in charge, swept the road with a broom in front of Lord Jagannath. Even though there was objection from the Communist Party of Bengal, nonetheless, these Russian citizens who were working there in the embassy of the Soviet Union, they, perseverance, in pursuance of this fact that they had endorsed the Hare Krishna movement as a bona fide religion within the Soviet Union, they carried out these ceremonies themselves. So this is a great milestone, because that Soviet, that Bengali Communist Party was often very difficult. Even though the Rath Yatra was a holiday all over Calcutta, often they tried to stop it. But then they saw the Russians themselves offering arti and dancing and sweeping the road. So at the present moment now, Krishna consciousness is spreading, books are being printed, and an official premises is being given to the movement there, in a building. And book distribution and Harinam is going on more than before. We started this Harinam as a great protest, and at first devotees were arrested, many times they were arrested, but when the Festival of India came last year to the Soviet Union, the devotees, many, many devotees came from different parts of Russia and chanted in front of the exhibit hall where the Indian exhibition took place. So the KGB surrounded them, but they were afraid to arrest them, thinking the Indian people there would object. So that was the beginning of, right about the beginning of the glasnost period. Anyway, one thing led to another. And through our ties with India and Indian culture and various other means, we were able to prevail. And now Harinam is going almost all year round in different parts of the country. Of course, it's not completely open. Sometimes there's still arrest, just as they do even in this country or in America, for minor violations of obstruction. But generally now they are tolerating much more than they ever had. And we see that they've accepted the fact that Prabhupada said once that once the poison is released, meaning his books, then it can't be reversed. So these books got into the Soviet Union somehow and nobody could stop their spread. As far as Red Chinese situation, I don't have a lot of detail. It's all very secretive at this time because it's a very delicate matter. I know books are printed and distributed in the Chinese language, and devotees are living in Red China, but our devotees there have told us that they are keeping it very quiet or very secret. I don't know, for this reason, for political reasons. But apparently they're having some good success, or they wouldn't be so concerned to keep it a secret. This is just within the last 2 or 3 months. That, of course, there has been some spread of Krishna consciousness in China, but hopefully sometime later this year we'll hear more. The good news can't be suppressed forever. Especially in ISKCON. We'll hear about it.
That most obedient wife thus fell down at the feet of her dead husband and began to cry pitifully in that solitary forest. Thus the tears rolled down from her eyes. Purport. Just as a devoted wife becomes afflicted in the passing away of her husband, when the spiritual master passes away, the disciple becomes similarly bereaved. This metaphor has many similes and analogies. This one is comparing the wife relationship with her husband to that of the disciple and the spiritual master. In Vedic culture, the wife is the disciple of the husband is the spiritual master of the wife. So this is the symbology being used here. And when the spiritual master departs this world, the disciple becomes very grievously afflicted and sheds tears. Due to the departure of the material body, but at the same time the disciple also feels after some time that the relationship between him and the spiritual master is continuing, and actually it's increasing. In the material world, those who identify with the body, they become very distraught at the loss of a loved one. And because they see that the body and is what my I am, they see that I am the body, and therefore, if one loses a loved one, then it is like the end. And sometimes we've even heard of instances where a wife will go to the graveyard and cry at the tombstone of her dead husband and asking God to bring him back, thinking that there's still life there somehow in that dead body. So in the material world, identifying with the body, as soon as there is bereavement of a loved one, grief is very intense, and it takes long time to get over such bereavement, sometimes years. But we know that since the soul is actually different from the body, that this soul has a destiny that is meted out to it according to its life and its karma by Yamaraj, and especially in relationship with the spiritual master. Prabhupada discusses it in some of the purports in this chapter, that the relationship actually increases after the departure of the spiritual master's demise of his material body. Prabhupada also discusses this at the end, the afterword of the Srimad, of the Chaitanya Chaitamrita. There's a description of the difference between Vani and Vapu. And he explains there that during the presence of the spiritual master, when we are associating with him in his Vapu form, we don't have as deep an appreciation as we do when we are worshipping the spiritual master in separation. And that separation is very acute, very intense after the departure of the spiritual master's body. The demise of this, of the body, and his departure for the spiritual world. Because one tends to take the presence of the spiritual master for granted when he's present in his lawful form. But this is not actually what makes the relationship strong. There's an instance in which Srila Prabhupada was explaining to one devotee. He was in India, in Delhi, and Jamuna told me this. She was sitting in the front of Prabhupada during the lectures, right in front, and somehow some people there objected in India. So she was told that she had to sit near the back because that was the custom in India. So she asked Prabhupada, why is this... she said, I feel deprived of your presence. I feel I'm not so close with you. So Srila Prabhupada said that the king has many servants and followers, but they're not necessarily important according to where exactly they're situated. And then he said this, the king is sitting on his big throne, and sometimes a mosquito comes and sits on the same throne. And all the time the king is thinking, when is this mosquito going to go away from us? He's going to bite me. So my point is, he was saying that physical presence is not necessarily a sign of intimacy with the spiritual master. So similarly, after the departure of the spiritual master and the demise of the material body, the disciple's love for him increases and increases, and actually becomes more intense than when the spiritual master is physically present. This is known as Vani. And Prabhupada explains in that afterword of the Chaitanya Chaitamrita that this Vani is actually greater than Vapu, because one worships the spiritual master with intense yearning, longing, and separation. When Krishna was with the gopis, sometimes he would disappear from their sight to make their love for him stronger. So in this form of the relationship between Radha and Krishna, or Parvati Ras, when Krishna is away and there is worship and separation, it is much more intense than when Krishna is there. We tend to take the spiritual master for granted when he is physically present. Nonetheless, when the spiritual master departs this material body, the disciples cry in great grief. But actually this crying is another form of intense love and deep relationship with Krishna. This crying is actually another form of expression of love. And it's also a form of unity with the spiritual master. When in the material world people cry for the departure or the presence of a loved one who's far away, it is a type of bereavement that has no cure. It's simply grief. But in the spiritual world, crying for Krishna or in the absence of the spiritual master crying for his presence, that is transcendental ecstasy of the highest order. And that's not, it's not only non-different from having the presence of the spiritual master, but it's even greater than having the presence of the spiritual master. So as Prabhupada writes in this chapter, in his purports, one who carries out the order of the spiritual master is entering into the most intimate association with the spiritual master. There's a picture that I saw in the temple in Munich of Srila Vishnupada giving some, presenting some books to the Murti of Srila Prabhupada at the farm in Germany. And this is, of course, after Srila Prabhupada departed, and I was thinking what a wonderful picture this is. Here's a disciple worshipping a spiritual master, Srila Shekhar, giving him a presentation of a big stack of books, and he looked so happy and so blissful. And I was thinking how wonderful this is, that he's worshipping Prabhupada in separation and pleasing Prabhupada, who's accepting this offering very much so, even though he's not physically there in his material body. But still he's accepting this nice offering. And this is evidence of how the spiritual master's instructions continue after he leaves this planet, and how one can gain deeper and deeper realizations and love for the spiritual master even after he has left this material world. And this type of worship of the spiritual master in his absence by carrying out his instruction is the essence of love for the spiritual master and Krishna. Prabhupada also, long after his spiritual master left, was so dedicated to carrying out his spiritual master's orders that he was never feeling vacant or the absence of his spiritual master. There's one famous incident when Vishnu John asked Prabhupada, he said, don't you miss your spiritual master sometimes? Don't you miss him? And Prabhupada was lecturing with this big Srimad Bhagavatam in front of him. He immediately lifted the Bhagavatam and touched it to his head, and he said, my spiritual master and I are never more separated than this. So in other words, by carrying out the orders of the Parampara to preach in the English language, Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada was feeling no separation. In fact, he was feeling great mercy of Srila Prabhupada, the presence of Srila Prabhupada. So the presence of the spiritual master is felt by carrying out his instructions, even if he's far away or if he's departed this material world. So this crying is a kind of ecstasy, longing for the spiritual master. And by executing the orders of the spiritual master, we feel the presence of the spiritual master very strongly. Just as Srila Prabhupada made a very specific instruction, he made many instructions, but he emphasized how much distributing the knowledge of Krishna consciousness through his books was the thing that gave him the most pleasure. And by carrying out that order, by distributing more books than when Srila Prabhupada was even here, we don't feel that Srila Prabhupada is away. We don't feel that he has gone away, that he is absent. But we should go into that today. Well, his presence here is stronger and stronger and stronger because he's pleased. And Janme Janme Prabhushe, our relationship with the spiritual master is eternal. So it goes on continuously. And the same is true of all the masters in the disciple succession. We have an eternal relationship with all of these spiritual masters. So to carry out their order is to develop more and more intimate association with them. So I'm going to read another verse. Text 50. Chitam daru chitam daru mayim chitta tasyam patyu kalevaram adipya chanumarane vilapanti manodare. She then prepared a blazing fire with firewood and placed the dead body of her husband upon it. When this was finished, she lamented severely and prepared herself to perish in the fire with her husband. Purport. It is the long-standing tradition of the Vedic system that a faithful wife dies along with her husband. This is called Sahamarana. In India, this system was prevalent even to the date of British occupation. At that time, however, a wife did not wish to die with her husband, was sometimes forced to do so by her relatives. Formerly, that was not the case. The wife used to enter the fire voluntarily. The British government stopped this practice, considering it inhuman. However, from the early history of India, we find that when Maharaj Pandu died, he was survived by two wives, Madri and Kunti. The question was whether both should die or one should die. After the death of Maharaj Pandu, his wife settled that one should remain and the other should go. Madri would perish with her husband in the fire, and Kunti would remain to take charge of the five Pandava children. Even as late as 1936, we saw a devoted wife voluntarily enter the fire of her husband. This indicates that a devotee's wife must be prepared to act in such a way. Similarly, a devoted disciple of the spiritual master would rather die with the spiritual master than fail to execute the spiritual master's mission. As the Supreme Personality of Godhead comes down upon this earth to reestablish the principles of religion, so his representative, the spiritual master, also comes to reestablish religious principles. It is the duty of the disciples to take the charge of the mission of the spiritual master and execute it properly. Otherwise, the disciple should decide to die along with the spiritual master. In other words, to execute the will of the spiritual master, the disciple should be prepared to lay down his life and abandon all personal considerations. Well, Prabhupada first talks about this sati rite of the wife entering fire along with her husband. The principle was that in Vedic culture, the wife was so attached to the husband that the fire of separation was greater than the fire of material fire, of burning. And therefore, it wasn't felt so intensely. So the purpose of this whole story is to teach us that actually we are not these material bodies, but they are temporary when we experience them, and that all our relationships that we experience in this material world are temporary. Prabhupada talks of the straws that are sometimes caught up in the tide of the river, in the waves of the river. They're washed into the river, and they come together for some time. They touch one another, and then they are washed away with the tide or the stream of the ocean with the current, never again to come in contact. So, as Paramjan became a woman in his next life, and then was reminded later on about this by Krishna as the super soul, one goes through many different forms of life, sometimes human beings, sometimes in female, sometimes in male bodies, sometimes in non-human bodies. Relationships are temporary. They come and they go. And according to our karma, we do not know where we will go from one place to another. We don't know whether we're going to end up as a tree or a cat or a demigod. We simply do not know. And the relationship which we do know, which we can cultivate and understand it in its everlasting form, is that of Gopi Bhartra Pada Kamala Manadas Vanadas Vanadas, or Jivara Svarupa Hoy Nitya Krishna Das. Our eternal relationship is as the servant of the servants of Krishna, or as the servant of Krishna. That's the eternal relationship. And when that relationship is in place, or when we actually have that developed properly, then it is possible to understand the relationship, our relationship with all living entities, humans and otherwise. So it's very mysterious how we change the body. There was a story of, in the Bhagavatamrita about King Chitraketu, whose son was called Harshashoka, which means lamentation and jubilation. He was a son for which one could have jubilation, and a son for which one could lament because he died very shortly after birth. So in all cases, all relationships are of Harshashoka. They're very happy. So we have relationships. We desperately need to relate to people in this material world. The whole impetus of living in this material world is to enjoy and to relate with others. And it is also lamentation. Harsha and Ashoka. Lamentation because the relationship will end at some time, either by the death of the person, other person, or by ourselves. So King Chitraketu also became enlivened about this whole situation. He was deeply aggrieved when Narada Muni, who's also the narrator of this story, and Angira Muni came to enlighten him, he finally understood and again was returned to his natural position of happiness. First he was happy, but this happiness of his son's arrival was based on material happiness. And then he began to lament because it was based on lamentation, material lamentation. But later on, when he was enlightened about the nature of the soul, having so many different fathers and mothers, when the dead child spoke to him and said, I've had so many millions of fathers and mothers, he began to understand that this is just a temporary position. It's a soul brought into this material world temporarily to be my son and then to go away. He began to realize that there's nothing to lament for because this soul is actually eternal. It's not dying. It's not disintegrating. It will go on and on. And I have temporarily had the association of this soul as my son. So similarly, the wife who followed the husband lamented at the death of the husband, but was able to actually enter into fire, considering the husband as a spiritual master, and that this fire of separation was very great, and that by voluntarily giving up this material body, one could attain perfection. Now Prabhupada goes into this next chapter and compares this to not wanting to leave the body before the spiritual master. Actually, it is the desire of some disciples that they don't want to leave the body before the spiritual master because they don't want to suffer the grief that comes by such separation. But the main point is that one has to execute the mission of the spiritual master, and
that's the beginning of understanding that we're not the body. And gradually that's a form of yoga that leads us